This week's newsletter links to an educational implementation of Elliptic Curve, Cryptography for Bitcoins, Sect 256K1 Curve. Also included are our regular sections with descriptions of discussions about changing consensus, announcements of new releases and release candidates, and summaries of notable changes to popular Bitcoin infrastructure software news. First, an educational and experimental-based Sect 256K1 implementation. Sebastian Falbisona, Jonas Nick, and Tim Ruffing posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list to announce a Python implementation of various functions related to the cryptography used in Bitcoin. They warn that the implementation is insecure, that is, in all capital letters, and intended for prototyping, experimentation, and education. They also note that reference and test code for several BIP, that's BIPS 340, 320, 4, 320, 7, and 350, 2 already includes custom and sometimes subtly diverging implementations of Sect 256K1. They hope to improve this situation going forward, perhaps starting with an upcoming BIP for Chill DKGC newsletter number 312. Changing consensus. A monthly section summarizing proposals and discussion about changing Bitcoin's consensus rules. First, multiple discussions about quantum computer theft and resistance. Several conversations examined how Bitcoiners could respond to quantum computers becoming powerful enough to allow stealing Bitcoins. Second, should vulnerable Bitcoins be destroyed? Jameson Lopp posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list several arguments for the destruction of Bitcoins vulnerable to quantum theft. This would happen after an upgrade path to quantum resistance has been adopted, and users have had time to adopt the solution. Some arguments include, first, argument from common preference. He believes most people would prefer that their funds be destroyed rather than stolen by someone with a fast quantum computer. Especially, he argues, since the thief will be among the few privileged folks who gain early access to quantum computers. Second, argument from common harm. Many of the stolen bitcoins will be either lost coins or those that were planned to be held long-term. By contrast, the thieves might quickly spend their stolen bitcoins, which reduces the purchasing power of other bitcoins. This is similar to money supply inflation. He notes that the lower purchasing power of bitcoins reduces miner income, which in turn reduces network security. And, in his observation, this results in lower merchant acceptance of bitcoins. First, argument from minimal benefit. Although allowing theft could be used to fund the development of quantum computing, stealing coins does not provide any direct benefit to honest participants in the Bitcoin protocol. Second, argument from clear deadlines. Nobody can know far in advance the date at which someone with a quantum computer can begin stealing bitcoins. However, a specific date at which quantum vulnerable coins will be destroyed can be announced far in advance with perfect precision. That clear deadline will provide more incentive for users to resecure their bitcoins in time, ensuring fewer total coins are lost. Third, argument from miner incentives. As noted above, quantum theft would likely reduce miner income. A persistent majority of hashrate consensus spending of quantum vulnerable bitcoins, which they might do even if the rest of Bitcoiners prefer a different outcome. Lopp also provides several arguments against the destruction of vulnerable bitcoins, but he concludes in favor of destruction. Nagiv Boris asks whether UTXOs that are time-locked beyond the upgrade deadline should also be destroyed. Lopp notes existing pitfalls of long time locks and says he personally gets a bit nervous locking funds for more than a year or two. First, securely proving UTXO ownership by revealing SHA-256 primage. Martin Habovsiak posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list an idea that could allow someone to prove they controlled a UTXO even if ECTSA and Schnorr signatures were insecure, for example, after fast quantum computers existed. If the UTXO contained a SHA-256 commitment or another quantum-resistant commitment to a primage that had never previously been revealed, then a multi-step protocol for revealing that primage could be combined with a consensus change to prevent quantum theft. This is fundamentally the same as a previous proposal by Tim Ruffing, as seen in newsletter number 141. He learned this is generally known as the Guy Fawkes signature scheme. It's also a variant of a scheme Adam Back invented in 2013 to improve resistance against miner censorship. In short, the protocol could work like this. First, Alice receives funds to an output that in some way makes the SHA-2-150-6 commitment. This can be a directly hashed output, such as P2PKH, P2SH, P2WPKH, or P2WSH, or it can be a P2TR output with a script path. Second, if Alice receives multiple payments to the same output script, she must either not spend any of them until she's ready to spend all of them. This is definitely required for P2PKH and P2WPKH. It is probably also practically required for P2SH and P2WSH. Or she's very careful to ensure at least one primage remains unrevealed by her spending. This is easily possible with P2TR key path verse is script path spends. First, when Alice is ready to spend, she privately creates her spending transaction normally, but does not broadcast it. She also obtains some Bitcoin secured by a quantum secure signature algorithm, so that she can pay transaction fees. Second, in a transaction spending some of the quantum secure Bitcoins, she commits to the quantum insecure Bitcoins she wants to spend. She also commits to the private spending transaction without revealing it. She waits for this transaction to be deeply confirmed. After she is sure her previous transaction practically cannot be reordered, she reveals her previously private primage and quantum insecure spend. 6. Nodes on the network search the blockchain to find the first transaction that commits to the primage. If that transaction commits to Alice's quantum insecure spend, then they execute her spend. Otherwise, they do nothing. This ensures that Alice does not have to reveal quantum vulnerable information until after she has already ensured her version of the spending transaction will take precedence over any attempted spend by the operator of a quantum computer. For a more precise description of the protocol, please see Ruffing's 2018 post. Although not discussed in the thread, we believe the above protocol could be deployed as a soft fork. Habifshag argues that bitcoins which can be securely spent using this protocol, for example, if their primage has not already been revealed, should not be destroyed, even if the community decides it wants to destroy quantum vulnerable bitcoins in general. He also argues that the ability to safely spend some bitcoins in case of emergency reduces the urgency of deploying a quanta resistant scheme in the short term. Lloyd Fournier says, quote, "If this approach gains acceptance, I think the main immediate action users can take is to move to a Taproot wallet." End quote. Because of its ability to allow keypath spending under the current consensus rules. This includes in the case of address reuse, but also offers resistance to quantum theft if keypath spending is later disabled. In a separate thread, see the next item, Peter Wewell notes that UXOs vulnerable to quantum theft also include keys that have not been used publicly, but which are known to multiple parties. This includes various forms of multisig, including Lightning Network, discrete log contracts, and escrow services. First, a draft BIP for destroying quantum insecure bitcoins. Agustin Cruz posted to the Bitcoin Dev mailing list a draft BIP that describes several options for a general process of destroying bitcoins that are vulnerable to quantum theft, if that becomes an expected risk. Cruz argues that enforcing a deadline for migration provides rightful owners with a clear, non-negotiable opportunity to secure their funds. He continues that a forced migration, with sufficient notice and robust safeguards, is both realistic and necessary to protect the long-term security of Bitcoin. Very little of the discussion on the thread focused on the draft BIP. Most of the discussion focused on whether or not destroying quantum-vulnerable Bitcoins was a good idea. This was similar to a thread that was later started by Jameson Lopp, as described in a previous section. First, there were multiple discussions about a CTV plus CSFS soft fork. Several conversations examined various aspects of soft forking in the OP check template verify, which is often called CTV, and the op check sig from stack, which is often called CSFS opcodes. Second, there was criticism of the CTV motivation. Anthony Towns posted a criticism of BIP 119's described motivation for CTV. He argued that this motivation would be undermined by adding both CTV and CSFS to Bitcoin. Several days after the discussion started, BIP 119 was updated by its author. Most and possibly all of the controversial language was removed. See newsletter number 347 for our summary of the change, and the older version of BIP 119 for reference. Some of the topics discussed included CTV plus CSFS allows the creation of a perpetual covenant. CTV motivation stated that covenants have historically been widely considered to be unfit for Bitcoin because they are too complex to implement and risk reducing the fungibility of coins bound by. Then, this BIP introduces a simple covenant called a template, which enables a limited set of highly valuable use cases without significant risk. BIP 119 templates allow for non-recursive, fully enumerated covenants with no dynamic state. Emphasis in original, Towns describes a script using both CTV and CSFS, and links to a transaction using it on the MutinyNet Signet. This transaction can only be spent by sending the same amount of funds back to the script itself. Although there was some debate about definitions, the author of CTV has previously described a functionally identical construction as a recursive covenant. Optek followed that convention in its summary of that conversation, as seen in newsletter number 190. Oleoluwa Osuntoke undefended CTV motivation related to scripts using it remaining fully enumerated and with no dynamic state. This appears to be similar to an argument the author of CTV, Jeremy Rubin, made in 2022. He called the type of pay-to-self covenant Towns designed recursive but fully enumerated. Towns countered that adding CSFS undermines the claimed benefit of full enumeration. He asked for either the CTV or CSFS BIP to be updated to describe any use cases that are somehow both scary and still prevented by the combination of CTV and CSFS. This may have been done in the recent update to BIP 119, which describes a self-reproducing automata, colloquially called spook chains. That would be possible using Siash Eniprov Hout, but which is not possible using CTV plus CSFS. Tooling for CTV and CSFS. Towns noted that he found it difficult to use existing tools to develop his recursive script described above, indicating a lack of readiness for deployment. Osuntoken said the tooling he uses is pretty straightforward. Neither Towns nor Osuntoken mentioned what tools they used. Nadav Ivgi provided an example using his Minsk language and said that he's been working on improving Minsk to make these kind of things easier. It supports Taproot, CTV, PSBT, descriptors, Miniscript, Raw Script, BIP30, 2, and more, although he admits much of it is still undocumented. Alternatives: Towns compares CTV plus CSFS to both his basic Bitcoin Lisp language, also known as Bilal, and Simplicity. These would provide an alternative scripting language. Antoine Poinsot suggests that an alternative language that is easy to reason about may be less risky than a small change to the current system, which is hard to reason about. Developer Moonsettler argues that incrementally introducing new features to Bitcoin script makes it safer to add more features later. Each increase in expressivity makes it less likely that we will encounter a surprise. Both Osuntoken and James O'Byrne criticize the readiness of Bilal and Simplicity in comparison to CTV and CSFS. CTV plus CSFS benefits. Stephen Roos posted to Delving Bitcoin to suggest adding CTV and CSFS to Bitcoin as a first step to other changes. These changes would increase expressivity further. Most of the discussion focused on qualifying the possible benefits of CTV, CSFS, or both of them together. This included, first, DLCs. Both CTV and CSFS individually can reduce the number of signatures needed to create DLC. This is especially true for DLC used for signing large numbers of variants of a contract. For example, a BTCUST price contract denominated in increments of $1. Antoine Poinsot linked to a recent announcement of a DLC service provider shutting down. He presented this as evidence that Bitcoin users don't seem too interested in DLC. He also linked to a post from a few months ago by Jonas Nick, who said, DLC have not achieved meaningful adoption on Bitcoin, and their limited use doesn't appear to stem from performance. Limitations, replies linked to other still functional DLC service providers, including one that claims to have raised $30 million in financing. Second, vaults. CTV simplifies the implementation of vaults that are possible today on Bitcoin using pre-signed transactions and, optionally, private key deletion. Anthony Towns argues that this type of vault isn't very interesting. James O'Byrne counters that CTV, or something similar, is a prerequisite for building more advanced types of vaults, such as his BOP3, 140, 5 OP volt volts, accountable computing contracts. CSFS can eliminate many steps in accountable computing contracts, such as BitVM, by replacing their current need to perform script-based Lamport signatures. CTV may be able to reduce some additional signature operations. Poinsot again asks about whether there's significant demand for BitVM. Gregory Sanders replies that he would find it interesting for bidirectional bridging of tokens as part of shielded client-side validation. See newsletter 322. However, he also notes that neither CTV nor CSFS significantly improve the trust model of BitVM, whereas other changes might be able to reduce trust or reduce the number of expensive operations in other ways. Improvement in liquid timelock script. James O'Byrne relayed comments from two Blockstream engineers. They stated that CTV would, in his words, drastically improve the Blockstream liquid timelock fallback script. This script requires coins to be moved on a periodic basis. After requests for clarification, former Blockstream engineer Sankit Kanjolkar explained that the benefit could be a significant savings in on-chain transaction fees. O'Byrne also shared additional details from Andrew Polstra, Blockstream's director of research. LN symmetry, CTV and CSFS together, can be used to implement a form of LN symmetry. This eliminates some of the downsides of LN penalty channels currently used in LN. It may also allow the creation of channels with more than two parties. This might improve liquidity management and on-chain efficiency. Gregory Sanders, who implemented an experimental version of LN symmetry, see newsletter number 280, for using Syosh Anyprovout, also known as APO, notes that the CTV plus CSFS version of LN symmetry isn't as featureful as the APO version and requires making trade-offs. Anthony Towns adds that nobody is known to have updated Sanders, his experimental code for APO to run on modern software, and to use recently introduced relay features such as truck and ephemeral. Anchors, furthermore, no one has ported the code to use CTV plus CSFS, limiting our ability to evaluate that combination for LN symmetry. Poinsot asks whether implementing LN symmetry would be a priority for LN developers if a soft fork made it possible. Quotes from two core Lightning developers who are also co-authors of the paper introducing what we now call LN symmetry indicated that it was a priority for them. By comparison, LDK lead developer Matt Corallo previously said, "I do not find LN symmetry all that interesting in terms of we need to get this done." First, Arc Roos is the CEO of a business building an Arc implementation. He says CTV is a game changer for Arc. The benefits of CTV to the user experience are undeniable, and it is without doubt that both Arc implementations will utilize CTV as soon as it is available. Towns noted that nobody has implemented Arc with either APO or CTV for testing. Roos wrote code doing that shortly thereafter, calling it remarkably straightforward, and saying that it passed the existing implementation's integration tests. He quantified some of the improvements. If they switched to CTV, he said they could net remove about 900 lines of code and reduce their own round protocol to 2 instead of 3, plus the bandwidth improvement for not having to pass around signing non-says and partial signatures. Roos would later start a separate thread to discuss the benefits of CTV for users of Arc. See our summary below. First benefit of CTV to Arc users. Stephen Roos posted to Delving Bitcoin a short description of the Arc protocol currently deployed to Signet, called Covenantless Arc, or CLArc. He explained how the availability of the OP check template, Verify Opcode, which is CTV, could make a covenantusing version of the protocol more appealing to users when it's eventually deployed to Mainnet. One design goal for Arc is to allow async payments. These are payments made when the receiver is offline. In CLArc, this is achieved by the spender plus an Arc server, extending the spender's existing chain of pre-signed transactions. This allows the receiver to ultimately accept exclusive control over the funds. The payment is called an Arc out-of-round payment, also known as ARCOR. When the receiver comes online, they can choose what they want to do. First, they can exit after a delay. This involves broadcasting the entire chain of pre-signed transactions, exiting the join pool, which is called an ARC. This requires waiting for the expiry of a time lock, agreed to by the spender. When the pre-signed transactions are confirmed to a suitable depth, the receiver can be certain they have trustless control over the funds. However, they lose the benefits of being part of a join pool, such as rapid settlement and lower fees deriving from Atxo sharing. They may also need to pay transaction fees to confirm the chain of transactions. Nothing, in the normal case, a pre-signed transaction in the chain of transactions will eventually expire. This will allow the server to claim the funds. This is not theft. It's an expected part of the protocol, and the server may choose to return some or all of the claimed funds to the user in some way. Until the expiry approaches, the receiver can simply wait. In the pathological case, the server and the spender can, at any time, collude to sign an alternative chain of transactions. This would steal the funds sent to the receiver. Note, Bitcoin's privacy proper is allow both the server and the spender to be the same person. Therefore, collusion might not even be required. However, if the receiver keeps a copy of the chain of transactions co-signed by the server, they can prove that the server stole funds. This might be sufficient to deter other people from using that server. Refresh, with server cooperation, the receiver can atomically transfer ownership over the funds in the spender co-signed transaction for another pre-signed transaction, with the receiver as a co-signer. This extends the expiration date and eliminates the ability for the server and previous spender to collude to steal the previously sent funds. However, refreshing requires that the server hold on to the refreshed funds until they expire, reducing the server's liquidity. Therefore, the server charges the receiver an interest rate until expiration, paid upfront since the expiration time is fixed. Another design goal for ARC is to allow participants to receive Lightning Network, or LN, payments. In his original post and a reply, Roos describes that existing participants who already have funds inside the join pool can be penalized up to the cost of an on-chain transaction if they fail to perform the interactivity required for receiving an LN payment. However, those who do not already have funds in the join pool cannot be penalized. Therefore, they can refuse to perform the interactive steps and costlessly create problems for honest participants. This appears to effectively prevent ARC users from receiving Lightning Network payments unless they already have a moderate amount of funds on deposit with the ARC server they want to use. Roos then describes how the availability of Covenant Tools, or CTV, would allow the protocol to be improved. The main change is how ARC rounds are created. An ARC round consists of a small on-chain transaction that commits to a tree of off-chain transactions. These are pre-signed transactions in the case of CL ARC, requiring all of the spenders in that round to be available for signing. If CTV was available, each branch in the tree of transactions could commit to its descendants using CTV with no signing required. This allows the creation of transactions even for participants who aren't available at the time the round is created, with the following benefits. First, in-round non-interactive payments are possible. Instead of ARC out-of-round payments, a spender who is willing to wait for the next round can pay the receiver in-round. For the receiver, this has a major advantage. As soon as the round confirms to a suitable depth, they receive trustless control over their received funds. This control lasts until expiration approaches, at which time they can either exit or cheaply refresh. Instead of waiting for several confirmations, the receiver can choose to immediately trust the incentives created by the ARC protocol for the server to operate honestly. You can find more information in newsletter number 253. In a separate point, Roos notes that these non-interactive payments can also be batched to pay multiple receivers at once. In-round acceptance of LN payments would allow a user to request an LN payment, also known as an HDLC, be sent to an ARC server. The server would then hold the payment until its next round. It would use CTV or Covenant technology to include an HDLC locked payment to the user in the round, after which the user could disclose the HDLC primage to claim the payment. However, Roos noted that this would still require the use of various anti-abuse measures. We believe this is because of the risk of the receiver failing to disclose the primage. This could lead to the server's funds remaining locked until the end of the ARC round, which might extend for 2 or more months. David Harding replied to Roos, asking for additional details. He compared the situation to LNJIT or just-in-time channels. These channels have a similar problem with non-revelation of HDLC primages, which creates problems for Lightning Service Providers, or LSPs. LSB currently address that problem through the introduction of trust-based mechanisms. See newsletter number 256 for more information. If the same solutions were planned to be used with CityVarc, those solutions would also seem to safely allow in-round acceptance of LN payments in CLARC. First, fewer rounds, fewer signatures, and less storage. CLARC uses MooSig2, and each party needs to participate in multiple rounds, generate multiple partial signatures, and store completed signatures. With CTV, less data would need to be generated and stored, and less interaction would be required. Second, op check contract verify semantics. Salvatore Ingele posted to Delving Bitcoin to describe the semantics of the proposed OP check contract verify, also known as CCV, opcode. He linked to a first draft BIP and a link to an implementation draft for Bitcoin Core. His description starts with an overview of CCV behavior. It allows checking that a public key commits to an arbitrary piece of data. It can check both the public key of the Taproot output being spent or the public key of a Taproot output being created. This can be used to ensure that data from the output being spent is carried over to the output being created. In Taproot, a tweak of the output can commit to tap leaves such as tap scripts. If the tweak commits to one or more tap scripts, it places an encumbrance, that is, a spending condition on the output. This allows conditions placed on the output being spent to be transferred to the output being created. This is commonly, but controversially, called a covenant in Bitcoin jargon. The covenant may allow satisfaction or modification of the encumbrance. This would, respectively, terminate the covenant or modify its terms for future iterations. Ingele describes some of the benefits and drawbacks of this approach. First, benefits. It is Taproot native, and it doesn't increase the size of Taproot entries in the UTXO set. Also, spending paths that don't require the extra day, so don't need to include it in their witness stack. So, there's no extra cost in that case. Second, drawbacks. It only works with Taproot. And checking tweaks requires elliptic curve operations that are more expensive than, for example, SHA-256 operations. Only transferring the spending conditions from the output being spent to an output being created can be useful. But many covenants will want to ensure some or all of the bitcoins in the output being spent are passed through to the output being created. Ingele describes CCV3 options for handling values. First, ignore, don't check amounts. Deduct, the amount of an output being created at a particular index, for example. The third output is deducted from the amount of the output being spent at the same index. The remaining value is then tracked. For example, if the output being spent at index 3 is worth 100 BTC, and the output being created at index 3 is worth 70 BTC, then the code keeps track of the remaining 30 BTC. The transaction is marked as invalid if the output being created is greater than the output being spent, as that would reduce the remaining value, perhaps below zero. Default, mark the transaction invalid unless the amount of output being created at a particular index is greater than the amount of the output being spent, plus the sum of any previous residuals. That haven't been used with a default check yet. A transaction is valid if any output is checked more than once with deduct, or if both deduct and default are used on the same output. Ingele provides several visual examples of combinations of the above operations. Here's our textual description of his send partial amount. Example, which might be useful for a vault. A transaction has one input, spending one output worth 100 BTC and two outputs, one for 70 BTC and the other for 30 BTC. CCV is run twice during transaction validation. 1. CCV with deduct operates index 0 for 100 BTC spent to 70 BTC created, giving a residual of 30. In a BIP3, 140, 5-style vault, CCV would be returning that 70 BTC back to the same script it was previously secured by. 2. The second time, it uses default on index 1. Although there's an output being created at index 1 in this transaction, there's no corresponding output being spent at index 1, so the implicit amount 0 is used. To that 0 is added the residual 30 BTC from the deduct call on index 0, requiring this output being created equal 30 BTC or greater. In a BIP 345 style vault, CCV would tweak the output script to allow spending this value to an arbitrary address after a time lock expires, or returning it to the user's main vault. Address at any time. Several alternative approaches that Ingela considered and discarded are discussed both in his post and the replies. He writes, I think the two amount behaviors default and deduct are very ergonomic and cover the vast majority of the desirable amount checks in practice. He also notes that he implemented fully featured vaults using OPCCV plus OPCTV that are roughly equivalent to BIP345. Moreover, a reduced functionality version using just OPCCV is implemented as a functional test in the Bitcoin Core implementation of OPCCV. First, a draft BIP was published for consensus cleanup. Antoine Poinsot posted to the Bitcoin dev mailing list a link to a draft BIP he's written for the consensus cleanup soft fork proposal. It includes several fixes. First, fixes for two different time warp attacks that could be used by a majority of hash rate to produce blocks at an accelerated rate. Second, a signature operations, or SIGUPS, execution limit on legacy transactions to prevent the creation of excessively slow-to validate blocks. Third, a fix for BIP30 for Coinbase transaction uniqueness that should fully prevent duplicate transactions. Fourth, invalidation of future 64 byte transactions calculated using stripped size to prevent a type of Merkle tree vulnerability. Technical replies were favorable for all but two parts of the proposal. The first objection, made in several replies, was to the invalidation of 64-byte transactions. The replies restated previous criticism, as seen in newsletter number 319. An alternative method for addressing Merkle tree vulnerabilities exists. That method is relatively easy for lightweight SPV wallets to use, but it might present challenges to SPV validation in smart contracts, such as bridges between Bitcoin and other systems. S. Jaws Provost suggested that someone implementing an on-chain enforceable bridge provide code illustrating the difference between being able to assume 64 byte transactions do not exist and having to use the alternative method for preventing Merkle tree vulnerabilities. The second objection was about a late change to the ideas included in the BIP, which was described in a post on Delving Bitcoin by Poinsot. The change requires blocks made after activation of consensus cleanup to set the flag that makes their Coinbase transaction lock time enforceable. As previously proposed, Coinbase transactions in post-act activation blocks will set their lock time to their block height, minus 1. This change means no miner can produce an alternative early Bitcoin block that uses both post-activation lock time and sets the enforcement flag. Because if they did, their Coinbase transaction wouldn't be valid in the block that included it, due to its use of a far future lock time. The inability to use exactly the same values in a past Coinbase transaction as will be used in a future Coinbase transaction prevents the duplicate transaction's vulnerability. The objection to this proposal was that it wasn't clear whether all miners are capable of setting the lock time enforcement flag. Releases and release candidates. New releases and release candidates for popular Bitcoin infrastructure projects. Please consider upgrading to new releases or helping to test release candidates. First, BDK Wallet 1.20 adds flexibility for sending payments to custom scripts. It fixes an edge case related to Coinbase transactions and includes several other features and bug fixes. LDK version 0.1.2 is a release of this library for building Lightning network-enabled applications. It contains several performance improvements and bug fixes. Bitcoin Core 29.0 release candidate 3 is a release candidate for the next major version of the network's predominant full node. Please see the version 20.9 testing guide. LND 0.19.0 beta release candidate 1 is a release candidate for this popular Lightning network node. One of the major improvements that could probably use testing is the new replace by fee-based fee bumping for cooperative closes. Notable code and documentation changes. Notable recent changes in Bitcoin Core, Core Lightning, Eclair, LDK, LND, Libsect2, 150, 6K1, Hardware Wallet Interface, HWI, Rust Bitcoin, BTC Pay Server, BDK, Bitcoin Improvement Proposals, BIPs, Lightning Bolts, Lightning Blips, Bitcoin Inquisition, and Binance. Bitcoin Core issue number 3, T, 1360-3 introduces the TX Graph class, see newsletter number 340. 1. A lightweight in-memory model of mempool. Transactions that tracks only ferrets and dependencies between transactions. It includes mutation functions such as add transaction, remove transaction, and add dependency. It also includes inspection functions such as get ancestors, get cluster, and count distinct clusters. TX Graph also supports staging of changes with commit and abort functionality. This is part of the Cluster Mempool project and prepares for future improvements to mempool eviction, reorganization handling, and cluster-aware mining logic. First Bitcoin Core number 31270-8 deprecates the setxv RPC command and the minus betxv startup option. These allow users to set a static fee rate for all transactions. Users should instead rely on fee estimation or set a per transaction fee rate. They are marked for removal in Bitcoin Core version 30.1.0. Second Eclair number 30.5.0 updates how Bolt 12 payment failures are relayed when the recipient is a directly connected node. It now always forwards the failure message, instead of overriding it with an unreadable invalid onion blinding failure. If the failure includes a channel update, Eclair overrides it with temporary node failure to avoid revealing details about unannounced channels. For blinded routes involving other nodes, Eclair continues to override failures with invalid onion blinding. All failure messages are encrypted using the wallet's blinded node ID. First, Eclair number 2963 implements one parent, one child, also known as 1P1C, package relay. It does this by calling Bitcoin Core's submit package RPC command during channel force closures. This broadcasts both the commitment transaction and its anchor together. This allows commitment transactions to propagate, even if their fee rate is below the mempool minimum. However, it requires connecting to peers running Bitcoin Core 28.0 or later. This change removes the need to dynamically set the fee rate of commitment transactions. It also ensures that force closures don't get stuck when nodes disagree on the current fee rate. Eclair version 3045 makes the payment secret field in the outer onion payload optional for single-part trampoline payments. Previously, every trampoline payment included a payment secret, even if a multipath payment, also known as MPP, wasn't used. Since payment secrets may be required when handling modern Bolt 11 invoices, Eclair inserts a dummy one on decryption if one isn't provided. LDK version 3670 adds support for handling and receiving trampoline payments, but does not yet implement providing a trampoline routing service. This is a prerequisite for a type of asynchronous payment that LDK plans to deploy. Asterisk LND version 9620 adds testnet 4 support by adding the necessary parameters and blockchain constants, such as its Genesis hash.